today I'm talking with Joe Abrams, who is an illustrious man from a diverse set of areas. And I've even actually got a list of things that Scott's given me to ask you about, maybe put you on the spot a little bit. Joe, why don't you take it away and tell us who you are and what you've done.
Sure. I guess my real background as an entrepreneur began in the early 1980s when I co-founded a small entertainment software company called the Software Toolworks. My cousin and I started the company in his garage in Sherman Oaks, California, Southern California, doing at first programming tools for operating systems before the Mac, before the IBM PC, for operating systems like CPM and even systems before that. And we grew that company organically. Eventually, we got 6 or 7 people. We moved out of his garage. And by 1988, we had grown to about $2 million in revenue. And at that point, we started branching out from actual pure publishing tools, C compilers, macro assemblers, things like that, to actually publishing applications which people were writing using our tools. So we had 2 hit products in the late 80s. One was Chess Master, a chess playing program. The other was Mavis Beacon Teaches Typing, a typing tutorial product. And we needed to raise a little bit of capital. We had grown the company all by sweat equity up until then. And through a combination of circumstances, we actually did a reverse merger in 1988. We raised a couple $1 million. We went public, and we had about a $10 million market cap. And then using that public currency as well as access to the capital markets, from 1988 till 1994, we grew the company to over $150 million in revenue. And then in 1994, we sold that company to Pearson, the big British publishing company, media company, for $460 million. And then I started working with small technology companies for the most part, and as both an investor and also helping in business development and other areas. And in 1999, I co-founded a company called eUniverse, a very early-stage Internet company. We later renamed that company Intermix, and our most famous website was a site called MySpace. And again, we started that company.
What is MySpace? I've never heard that.
Well, you know, it's sort of interesting because when I started Software Toolworks and went around to talk to investment banks, venture capitalists about the company, nobody had heard of the category called entertainment software, believe it or not, in 1985, 86, 87. Electronic Arts was a public or big company. There was no, of course, Take-Two, Activision. And what would happen would be I would go around to people and I would say we're an entertainment software company, and they'd say, wait a minute, you're not Microsoft and you're not Disney. We really don't know what you are. And the same thing happened when we went around talking to people about MySpace back in 2004, 2003. People would say, well, what's social networking? We really haven't heard about social networking. And really our concept from the very early days of the company was to create a viewership. And in fact, by the time we started germinating the idea for MySpace, we had 40 or 50 million people a month coming to our various websites. There were sites like yourbabyphotos.com and game sites and health and nutrition sites, a whole host of sites. And our idea was kind of...
Actually, can I just jump in?
Sure.
Before we go down this, because this is a big story and there's a lot to ask you, but I've actually got a bigger, more personal question I'd like to ask before, if I may.
Sure.
I'm dying to know, was it your company that published Defender of the Crown?
Defender of the Crown, no. Defender of the Crown, that was CinemaWare.
Okay. So did you publish
CinemaWare was actually we at Software Toolworks in 1989 we acquired a company called Mindscape.
Right. And Mindscape that published Defender of the Crown?
Yes. Mindscape distributed Defender of the Crown, correct. On the Amiga.
So you did distribute, you didn't write or manage the programming team.
That's correct.
So I am correct in associating Mindscape with Defender of the Crown, but you didn't actually write it.
That's correct.
And so this was your company that was distributing like the breakthrough game on the Amiga?
Yes, we were very, very early stage Amiga developers, which I know you're from Australia, and Amiga was a very, very important hardware platform in Australia.
You have no idea. It was my childhood, so I hope I get the privilege of playing, since I live in the Caribbean, a rum and coke sometime.
Okay, not a Foster's, though.
No, that's tough.
Okay.
Can you tell me more about that day? I mean, I'm such a maniac. I told Scott that when I was last time in the Bay Area, I went and drove around and took photos of the offices where the Amiga was founded in, I think it's in Sunnyvale. And went over to where Epix was.
Oh, sure.
That's an apartment building now. And I actually even found the house of Jack Tramiel and went up and had a look at that
really?
As well.
Well, yes. Let's see. Well, let me see some of the stories. There's some of the stories I don't mind telling you for publication, and then there are other stories we'll have to do over rum and coke. How's that?
Okay.
When we started the company and we started publishing things like games, back in the early 1980s, there were very, very few retail outlets for software products. This was before in the U.S. Egghead Software and some of the software-only specialty stores. None of the big-box retailers like Walmart carried software. It was very, very difficult to get distribution. So I was always looking about how to get distribution. And I actually wrote a letter to Zenith Corporation, which not only made the Zenith computers, but also made the old Heathkit computers. And we wrote them a letter, my cousin and I, and we said, you know, we're a software company, we're writing these programs, and we have them for sale, and we'd like to maybe leverage your distribution channel for the hardware, because certainly people who are buying hardware will be interested in buying software. Are you interested in being our distributor? And they wrote back a letter that said, there's no money to be made in software. All the money in this business is in the hardware business. And so they declined to distribute it. Yeah, right. And so they declined it. And so, and in fact, probably up through up through the mid-1990s, people really thought that the money in this business was going to be made in the hardware. And so we were very fortunate that we got into the software business at the right time. And back then, you know, all of these new platforms, I mean, we were developing for the Atari 8-bit, Commodore 64, Atari ST, Amiga, Apple II, Apple IIGS, Apple III, PC, PC Junior, a whole host of platforms. So every time we would develop a game, we would have to go out and find programmers who were specialized in that particular hardware. And it was quite an interesting development process. And one of the things which I think made us successful is that we developed across many, many platforms. And as a result, what somebody would see somebody doing a game on the Amiga, and even if they were developing for the Commodore 64, once they could see an effect, like some form of animation or some technique that was used, they would sit down and they would say, why can't I make that work in a Commodore 64? And so our products looked very, very state-of-the-art for each hardware platform that we were developing.
So on that point, I've got to ask you, I mean, I was pretty tied into demo scene back then. We always looked at you guys like out in California doing this amazing stuff. I mean, you have no idea the influence you have on my life. Like, my mother will never, if my mother meets you, she'd be really angry at you because, like, my childhood was lost to, like, your stuff. You have no idea. But we looked at you guys as, like, making all these amazing games, but you didn't really seem to get the demo scene or any of the stuff that we were doing. Like, how did you view, like, the European demo scene back then?
Well,
Amiga and Commodore 64, I only had those two friends around.
Right. Yes, it was, you know, it was kind of interesting because for us, we were selling, I would say that we were probably selling 10 or 15 to 1 on the PC for every one that we sold on the Amiga. So for us, 90%+ of our sales was for the IBM PC. And so even though there were pockets of Commodore 64 and pockets of Apple, and it tended to be almost country by country, not even territory by territory. So, you know, Germany was a huge Atari ST market. France was a huge Apple market. The Amiga was not that big in the UK, but the Amiga was very, very big in Australia. And at that point, the Australian market was relatively small. I opened up our first office there in 1987 or 1988, and a good-selling title on the Amiga might sell 2,000 or 3,000 copies in Australia, when the U.S. a good-selling title on the PC would sell 100,000 copies, and a good selling title on the Amiga in the U.S. would only sell 2,000 or 3,000 copies.
So what about Germany? I mean, Germany did sell a lot, and I mean, in UK was pretty strong from that perspective.
Well, yeah, Germany, the German market was really the big market was the Atari ST, was actually bigger than the Amiga, and the game market, there was a different at that time. There was a different type of game market in Europe. The type of games which sold in Europe were much more movie oriented, less strategy oriented. Where in the U.S. they seem to be more interested in long-term gameplay than actual graphics. And I think it probably came out of the fact that that market was originally the Commodore 64 on cassette tape. I don't know if you're old enough to remember Commodore 64 loaded Commodore 64 games on cassette. Okay. And in fact, the precursor to that was, of course, the Timex Sinclair. I don't know if you even remember that machine. Right, okay. Yes, and I actually...
No, I started on a Commodore 64. Yeah. I was high-end. I actually had a Commodore 64 and a 1541 disk drive.
Yeah. But those were, and in fact, you know, at some point you probably should try to get a hold of Bob Kotick at Activision, because he is very good friends with Jack Tremaine.
Oh, really?
And, or was good friends with Jack's son, and actually started in the Amiga business. And in fact, his company, I even forgot what his company was called, it's been so long ago, actually took over the Activision brand name. So Bobby could tell you a lot of things about the very early days of the Amiga as well.
I mean, I could talk to you for hours about this.
I can tell.
A little bit mindful of our listeners. I just want to ask you then one question. I mean, you went through a big wave of that time before. You went through, I don't know whether you call it anything like a bubble, but it certainly was a growth of the industry. But you were on it from the side that I understood better. You weren't out there competing with Microsoft and doing that sort of stuff. How did that feel? How was it when all this was going on? Did you recognize, or where did you recognize that Microsoft was something serious?
Believe it or not, we were, back in 81 or 82, we were close to the same size as Microsoft. There were more games being sold. Back in the early 80s, Microsoft was really focused on being a tools company. It wasn't until they did the deal with IBM, I think the IBM PC maybe in 1982 or something. One of the things which I've tried to do over my career is to segregate. There are two types of competitors that I look at. One type is the traditional business that's going into new technology. So whether it's a movie company going into the software business or, a book publishing company going into the social networking business, those type of companies don't scare me. In fact, I look at them as opportunities. I've done a lot of things in the digital photography business competing against Kodak, and it's relatively easy to compete against traditional companies going into new media or new technology businesses because they just don't understand the culture. There's a certain culture that it takes to create products for new technologies. It's a combination of engineering and creativity, and managing that whole process is unique. And that's why I think even today you don't see people coming out of Procter & Gamble to be heads of entertainment software companies or heads of internet companies. People have tried. People have tried to get traditional managers to come into those kind of environments. They just don't seem to succeed. But the other type of competitors that do scare me are competitors which have grown out of that industry, so that the Microsofts and the Googles and things like that. And those companies I tend to try to stay away from. So we never try to compete in the flight simulator market with Microsoft. And I would never try to compete on the internet side of a business, in the search engine business, with Google. I mean, they've grown up in that space. But if it does not concern me at all, when Disney says we're going to go into the entertainment software business, or if Disney were to say we're going into some form of an internet venture, it doesn't concern me because I just don't think that the bigger companies have it's not in their DNA. And in fact, I've had conversations with people within those organizations, and what they've said to me off the record is their greatest difficulty is attracting and keeping people who have the skills to compete in those kind of genres. Because when you think about it, if I'm Viacom and I decide I want to do software products and I run an ad and I try to get a bunch of programmers in that kind of environment, I'm not going to get the same kind of quality of person I'm going to get if I say, look, I want to put 8 people in a rented house and I want you guys to do the next killer game and here's a whole bunch of pizza and a whole bunch of coffee and I'll see you in 6 months or 8 months. You just don't get that kind of energy and imagination if you're working at Viacom in an office building in Manhattan and you're expected to come in at 9 o'clock in the morning and leave at 6 o'clock at night. So that's kind of a long-winded answer to your question, but I would avoid big competitors in businesses that are, in which they've grown up in. So I would have people come to me all the time and say, I could write a better spreadsheet than Microsoft Word. And I would say, I'm sure you could write a better spreadsheet than Microsoft Word, but there's no way that I'm going to compete on the sales and marketing side of that juggernaut. So I'm not going to compete in word processing or in database software with Oracle or whatever. We'll find a niche where we can compete and succeed. And one of the things about all these businesses is that there's plenty of room to compete and make money and build big companies without tackling these guys head on.
That's really interesting because I just interviewed Jason from 37 Signals, and his DNA is very much coming out of internet development. And everything you're saying says to me that he would be a tough guy to compete with. He's only small, FM guy, but it resonates exactly. Whereas he's the opposite of any kind of a Viacom, that's for sure.
Yeah. I mean, I've done it in digital photography. I've done it in solar. I've done it in the internet space. I've done it in consumer software. It doesn't matter the market size, and it doesn't matter the size of the competitor, but it does matter the type of competitor that you're going up against.
Very interesting. All right, I need to take a quick detour because Scott insisted that I ask you this question. You have some story about Che Guevara.
Yes, I do.
Before you start, I actually visited his tomb in Cuba.
Okay. Well, my first boss I ever had was from Cuba, and he was in exile, and he was a CPA. and he had grown up, spent all his life in Cuba, and when Castro took over, he applied for an exit visa. And what happened would be when you applied for an exit visa back in the late 50s, two things would happen. Either they would take you away from your family and put you in a sugarcane field for some amount of years, or they would take you and they would, if you had a particular skill, they would take you to a remote part of Cuba and let you ply that trade, but in a place where you couldn't talk to anybody or see anybody. So in this particular case, he was a CPA and he was very good. And so one day they came and they took him and they said, you're not going to be running this sugarcane factory at the remote far end of the island. And so he basically packed a suitcase and left and went out there. And he started running this factory. And about 3 months later, three Jeeps come rolling up. And in the front Jeep is Che Guevara, who is the Minister of Economics. And he walks out, he's got a machine gun, he's got the bandolier strap, and he's got the army uniform. And he walks into the office, and across all around the office, he's got graphs showing production and costs and things like that. And Che Guevara starts at one end of the office and walks around and looks at all the graphs, and then he walks over to the desk, and of course my friend, my boss, is sitting there shaking because he has no idea what's going on, and he reaches over and he shakes his hand and he says, congratulations, of every place I've toured, this is the only place I've been able to come in and find everything that I needed to know about a company without asking one question. And he turned around and he left. And so I've always remembered that story, and what I've tried to be able to do in the companies where I've managed or helped mentor people who are managing their company is to develop some kind of a system whereby anybody can figure out what is going on with a company without having to call somebody and say, how are sales, or sales trending up, how are profits, how is traffic, whatever the key metric is by which you need to measure your business, you ought to be able to develop some way to represent that and distribute that so that you can communicate it in the fewest possible words.
Well, I got to say, Jeff, you've been telling me this story 20 years ago, and before you'd done release the Fender of the Crown, I would be laughing at you for taking business advice from Cuban socialists. But given your track record, I'll give you a pass on that.
No, I'm always, I guess part of it is because I have an independent entrepreneurial spirit, and I always resented when I was working for somebody if they would come over and say, what's going on? How's it going? What do you do? You know, things like that. I always felt like that implicit in something like that is you're not doing what you're supposed to be doing, or we don't trust that you're doing it. So I always tried when I started managing people, and to this day, is to try to understand what people need in order to make their job easier. That's what we need to do. And I know, for example, my cousin, who really is the engineer, the programmer. If I would walk over to him and say, when's the product going to ship, or is it on time, that would make him, crazy, as opposed to saying, is there anything I can do? What's the bottleneck? Is there a way that with other resources, or I can help smooth and make your job easier? Because implicit in doing something like that is the fact that I know you're doing the best you can. Now, how can I do the best I can to help you?
Okay, so assuming that, how do you know that I'm doing the best I can?
Well, there are a number of ways you can do it. First is experience. Okay, if you have experience in doing the kind of jobs that people are doing, that is always the best way. The other way is by asking people to break down jobs or assignments into things which are manageable and milestone dates. So having somebody say that it's a 15-man-month project, two people, 7.5 months, that's one thing. Having people say, in order to deliver this product in a year, that means it's got to go to Gold Master in 10 months, which means it has to go to Beta in 8 months, which means it has to go to Alpha in 6 months, which means that we have to have a spec by such and such a day, with all of the built-in things which you need, whether it's third-party approval on intellectual property, whether it's license approval by a hardware manufacturer, whether it's compatibility with some other things that you're trying to do, and you basically back it up into small manageable parts. And if someone says, I'll have a spec to you in a week, and the spec comes to you in 2 weeks, well, that tells you that their next milestone is probably going to be late. And if it is late, then you have a problem. As opposed to saying to people, well, I'm hiring you to do your job, I'll see you in 7 months. So that's, you know, and then when it's 2 weeks late, when the spec is 2 weeks late, and someone says, well, the reason it's 2 weeks late is because I didn't have enough people on the project, then you can say, okay, where are we going to find the resources to make sure that the next milestone isn't late? Or how can we bring the project back in? You know, where do we have cushion? Where can we put resources?
You
where can we do
something? The constraints and all that sort of stuff.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so and maybe that's one of the reasons why when people who do not have experience in these kind of industries come in as CEOs, having not had that experience to manage those kind of processes, they have a very, very difficult time in grasping with these things. Because most intellectual property pursuits are never done. A book is never done. A movie is never done. A software product is never done. It's never perfect. It's never finished. So the key is having the ability to recognize that it's commercially viable. Mm. You know, all you have to do is look at Microsoft's Vista to see that, you know, that an operating system is never done. Okay, whether or not it's commercially viable or not, you know, that they're probably a better judge of that or not. That's the key. You know, there's never right. Every bug is found. Everything's perfect.
Got it. We're moving through our time here. I feel like it's going to end up in the 6-hour interview if we're not careful. We do have to finish up in about 25 minutes. So,
okay.
Why don't you tell us your big story about Intermix and MySpace? You started telling us about how
sure.
You helped found Intermix. Now, I'm interested. I want to just ask one quick question. I looked
yes.
at Brad Green. I think his name is Brad Greenspan. I looked at
yes.
his page, and he says that he's the one true founder of MySpace.
Yes.
And I know there's other guys out there who are also they are one true founder of MySpace. I'm curious as to who is the one true founder of MySpace.
Yes. Well, what do they say, right? Success has many fathers, and failure is an orphan.
Yeah.
So I will, and it's also interesting because I've done some interviews with a reporter for the Wall Street Journal who's publishing a book on it, and so I've had this conversation numerous times, and so I think everybody comes from their own perspective, and Brad and I co-founded the company, so you know Brad and I were the first two shareholders. I'll give you my take on it, which basically what we. And you have to roll it back a little bit and say, you know, what was the original concept of the company? And like I told you at the beginning, it was more, you know, I kind of viewed it as the cable TV model. Let's build a network of viewers, and then we'll have these little stations. So we'll have, you know, a health and nutrition station, and we'll have a photo sharing and joke of the day, and we had a Beanie Baby site. We had a video gamers reviewer site called Gamers Alliance. We had a challenge ladder called Cases Ladder where people could challenge each other in particular video games and move up and down a ladder based on their scores. We had a whole bunch of these sites. And then, of course, we said, well, we need to start to figure out how to make money out of this. And so the first thing we started to do was we started to try to sell advertising. And we started selling advertising then, of course, in 2000, that whole model blew up. And so we were having a fairly difficult time selling advertising. So we said, okay, let's go and sell products. Let's go into e-commerce. And we started to do inkjet cartridges, you know, reusable inkjet cartridges. And we sold everything from Salt Lake City Olympic berets to health and nutrition products. And we got fairly successful in that, but really
well,
we didn't...
You mean Hydrodem. You did pretty well with Hydrodem, right?
Yes. Yeah, well, okay, Hydrodem's a little bit later. We're talking 2001, 2002.
Okay.
You know, in the depths of the bubble, okay. So... Then we said, well, you know what? We're really not experts in marketing. Let's go and buy a marketing company. So we bought a marketing company, and the guys who started that marketing company came to work for us, and they really helped evolve into the Hydroderm and all of that. But they had an idea that had been percolating in the back of their mind for a social networking site. Of course, this is back before anybody knew what social networking meant.
Was this, I mean, when we're talking like Avogadro and the FOAF protocol, friend of a friend protocol, I mean, were you guys looking at it back then, or were you only looking at it after Friendster came around?
We were looking at it probably at the same time as Friendster, but we were definitely behind them.
Right.
In other words, when we launched MySpace, Friendster had already had, was out there and starting to grow. And their idea originally for MySpace, they said, look, we have this idea, we're amateur musicians, we think there's an opportunity to do kind of a small thing where people who are looking for band members can get together and say, I'm in LA, I'm looking for a drummer, and yeah, you know, this is the kind of music I like to play, et cetera, et cetera. So they basically went to Brad and they said, Brad, you know, we have this idea, and what we'd like to do is we'd like to create this idea and plug it into the Intermix network. And from there, it gets fuzzy, okay? If you talk to Brad, Brad will say, yeah, they sort of came to me with this idea, but I really had an idea. I, you know, it was really my concept and my implementation of the concept. And, you know, they'll say, no, it was my idea, my implementation of the concept, and, you know, basically we just leveraged off the intermixed traffic.
Well, no, so, I know about this. I'm trying to think it was my idea. I'm trying to think that I was much better on my lab.
Right. Well, and so what happened was, the one thing I can tell you is it was not my idea.
Okay.
So, and so what happened was they plugged it into the network, and inside of 3 months we could really see that it was going to be bigger than a whole network. So, you know, we knew we had lightning in the bottle.
Was the goal to build a social network and get traffic so that you can then monetize that traffic?
Absolutely.
To build a social network and a user base? I mean, did you want to grow traffic so that then you could buy that traffic out to your other property like Hydrogen?
Correct. That was clearly the idea. It started as a marketing vehicle, but it gradually took over everything else. And in fact, that's why the reason why News Corp bought us was for MySpace, which they had used successfully as a promotional vehicle for some of their TV shows and some of their movie properties. So it really wasn't until after they bought the company that MySpace went to the next level. So they were buying it as a marketing and promotional tool and saying, because when you think about it, the number one TV show in the world, of course, is American Idol, right? And that gets 30... Excuse me?
I'm not willing to negotiate on that. It's the 18 from the 1980s. Back when I had in my knee.
All right.
American Idol made number two.
All right. So, you know, and that show gets 30 million viewers. Okay, so something like that. And here are these internet properties that are getting 40 or 50 million viewership, and 90% of them are right in the sweet spot of what every movie company, TV company, advertiser wants to reach. And they're coming there for more than 45 minutes a day, and they're sharing a lot of information that people want to know on that side. And so at the end of the day, it's you can make an argument that it's more, even though the revenues aren't there, they will be someday, and it's probably as valuable as the TV network. So paying $580 million is nothing.
Being far more valuable in time. But,
today's San Francisco Chronicle, there was an article about how all the local TV stations are laying off 15 or 20% of their staff because what's happening is they're, you know, people are not watching TV. One of the things which is happening is, you know, it, like most great ideas, they've happened many times before. When radio came in and started to compete against newspaper, radio's viewership grew very, very rapidly, but the advertising on radio grew very slowly. It probably took 20 years or 30 years for the advertising revenue to equalize between radio listenership and newspaper readership. When television came in, that was the next fad, and it took probably 10 years this time for advertising revenues to equalize on television viewership versus radio listenership. And now in the internet, it will probably take between 5 and 10 years for that to equalize. But there's another...
Because those models are branding driven, so there's more trust and understanding of metrics that's required, or, you know...
No, I think it's exactly the opposite. I think it's momentum. I think a lot of people say, I can't get fired for spending $15 million on a Super Bowl ad. You know, nobody will say, what were you doing, you know, spending money on the Super Bowl, you know, to reach, you know, 30 million people or 50 million people for a minute. But if I spent $5 million on an internet ad campaign, I'd be fired in 30 seconds to reach 10 times as many people for 10 times longer.
So what I'm saying is then the CPMs are going to dramatically increase.
Yes. And whether it's CPMs or CPAs, because for the first time advertisers have a way to actually measure the effectiveness of their advertising. And they're
right.
Just starting to realize that now. Is saying, well, instead of running an ad that people will TO past or become immune to, I can create an ad with call to action where I can actually measure how many people actually bid something. And then on the other side, I can only pay for people who actually do what I want them to do.
Mm.
So, you know, I can go to Coke and I can say, I guarantee you that 50,000 people will enter this sweepstakes, which is sponsored by Coke. I may get 6 million people who see that ad, but I guarantee you that 50,000 of them, I'll run it until 50,000 of them actually enter my contest. And that's how you'll know that not only did I reach 50,000 people, but they did a call for action where they saw your logo and your message on that. And this is the first time that an advertiser can actually measure that, as opposed to either a Nielsen rating or an impression or a billboard, you know, where they're measuring traffic drive-bys. And once people learn the power of that and how to measure that, what will happen is instead of, you know, 5 or 6% of advertising dollars being spent on the internet, it'll be 70 or 80%. So it's that kind of dramatic shift that's going on in the advertising community that makes it an exciting area.
Yeah. Now, I want to ask you quick questions about MySpace, if I may.
Yes.
Now, I was reading on Brad Greenspan's site, and he was talking about how they plugged MySpace into the various properties that you already had, and that's what got it, gave it its initial kick.
Yes.
But I also understood the key part was the email software, the email company that you bought and acquired, and so you were good at getting mail through. Was a key driver of signups the fact that you plugged into those properties and then people just informally inviting each other, or was it a whole address book importing process that people were using and then you sending out lots of invites?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, and I'm not sure. It grew so fast. I mean, you're talking about a site that was growing 10 or 15 million users a month.
Hmm.
And it's one of those things where we were doing so many things. The viral marketing was working, the email delivery was working, the internet was exploding in general. The functionality of the site was good. When we started doing this, Friendster was the gold standard. And in 5 or 6 months, they became, in effect, a bankrupt company.
Right.
So we were doing a whole lot of things. I'm not exactly sure what was the big driver. And I guess that's another kind of operating principle that I've had, which, you know, it's sort of like when you go, you have to go out and tell the story in as many different ways as possible. And I think you have to be creative about the way in which you do it. So, yes, you want to do affiliates, viral marketing, sweepstakes, contests, traditional PR, all of those things. Because when you have something which is working and you're pouring fuel on that fire, it goes crazy. And so I don't usually try to figure out what's the one best thing to do. I try to do as many things as possible and let the market tell me if it's working or not. And then if it's working, it's like in the old days with software, we've got to hit product. I would increase the advertising budget. People tended to decrease the advertising budget because they'd say, I don't need the advertising because my product is selling well.
You're pouring gasoline on the bot.
Yeah, I was saying, I've got a hot product here. I need to advertise and promote it because that product's pulling the rest of my product line along with it. So I need to support the retailers. I need the retailers talking about it. I want the people, I want people in the stores talking about it. I want consumers asking about it, the whole thing. So that's always been kind of my philosophy. So that's what I try to do.
Now, I've got to ask you another big question. You've done something that's kind of astonishing. You've hit like massive home runs through two booms, through the first one in the dawn of the computer industry and then with MySpace.
Well, I didn't tell you about the third one either.
Why, there's another one?
Yes.
Tell me that.
Sure. About 15 months ago, I took a company public in the solar space called Akina Solar, AKNS, a good friend of mine from the software business. Again, if you could believe it, 15 months ago when I was going around with a solar company, people were asking me, what's solar and why should we invest in it, buy it, and believe in it? And today that company is a $250 million market cap company, very successful company.
Congratulations.
So it's another industry. So I've actually, in the public markets, I actually had three companies where when they started, nobody knew what industry they were in, but have become, very, very big winners.
But I'm happy to hear that you didn't manage to do anything during the 90s boom at the end of the 90s, did you?
Well, the only one we did was Intermix. And again, because I come from a sweat equity entrepreneurial background, we raised $7 million at Intermix, but rather than go out and spend $2 or $3 million on doing, advertising or traffic acquisition deals, we used our public currency to acquire companies that already had traffic, and that's how we built our network. So, and I'm a believer in small companies that have great management, using public currency to build their companies into mid-sized companies. Having done three times.
Can you tell us a bit more about that? I mean, you've got the audience now of 450 Muslim CEOs mm-hmm. running exactly these kinds of companies that can bloom into things. What are you looking for? A lot of these guys, they're cash flow positive. They've got offers running. They're sort of like in a mix. They've got might have Hydroderm or a couple of other things that are running. The CEO's got the train's running on time pretty well. He's got time free. He's flying around in a private plane or all that kind of stuff. Why would he care about talking to Joe Abrams?
Well, it's not for everybody being the CEO of a public company. It's not for a lot of people. There are, they're just like everything else, there are good points and bad points. The bad points are you're in front of the public eye all the time. You really work for the shareholders, whereas if you're the CEO and you own 100% of the company, you work for yourself. You probably have to spend a third of your time involved in things that are necessary to being a public company, investor conferences, things like that. Okay, that's the bad news. The good news is it's a way to build incredible wealth. I mean, you can go back and look at how many shares I had that Software ThoughtWorks only sold $13 a share, and how many shares, you know, Brad and I had of Intermix when we sold, and how many shares Barry Cinnamon has of Akina Solar today, and see that it's a way to build incredible wealth. That's from the individual standpoint. In terms of raising capital, there's no better way to raise capital than in a public company.
I talked with someone about this very point the other day, and their feeling was, man, reporting requirements and all that stuff have gotten so hard that I'd rather just be acquired and manage away quietly rather than go through and go public, just given the environment with in the public market today.
Well, again, having sold two public companies, I can tell you the easiest and best way to sell a company is both of those transactions, by the way, took less than 60 days. And there was almost no discussion of value. Because when you're a public company, the only question is, how much of a premium over my stock price am I going to pay? Whereas when you're a private company, then you get into issues of this is what I'm worth and earnouts and you know, all these kinds of weird mechanisms. And you can spend months and months and months arguing over valuation. At the end of the day, it's still an art, not a science. And when markets get like this, the premiums that companies will pay shrink dramatically. So, which is an advantage when you're public because you can use your currency to buy those companies at cheaper prices. There are very few IPOs being done. Most companies, which are mature companies, which already have revenues and profits, are really not candidates for venture capital money anymore. And venture capital comes with its own baggage. So then the only alternative, if you need to raise capital, is the private equity market, which is every bit as onerous or maybe more onerous than the venture capital market. So there are very, very few alternatives for people today in terms of raising capital. But I would say to you, if I had a business and it was generating, you know, $5 or $10 million a year in profit, and I was putting all that in my pocket, and I was flying around on my private jet, I'm not sure I would go public, okay? But if I was doing $5 or $10 million in year revenue and trying to figure out how am I going to get to $100 million in revenue, and I was making a salary but I wasn't building any wealth, and I was trying to figure out how am I going to get bigger faster, and how am I going to compete, because all of these businesses have shelf lives. You either have to grow bigger and bigger, or you get less significant and less significant. And if you're one product, one market company where you haven't spread your risk around, then you really run into a situation where you're just one competitor away. A perfect example, by the way, is Friendster. You know, Friendster, I think, turned down a $50 or $60 million offer from Google by their company, and 3 months later they were bankrupt.
Yeah.
You know, you have a very narrow window as a private company sometimes, and if you don't take advantage of that window, you're doomed. So I like being a public company because there's always access to capital. Yeah, your stock price may be down, but you can always have access to capital. And if you do want to trade sell your company, you typically get a two-step bump. You get a bump from being a public company, and then you get a bump as a premium that people are willing to pay in the market. So for me, the pain is worth the pleasure.
Would you rather be – so you're okay with being like a thinly traded, you know, on a pink sheet or on one of the smaller exchanges?
I wouldn't do pink sheet, but I'd do over-the-counter all day long, sure. Absolutely. These companies all start, like Akina and Software Tours, we all start over the counter, and then when you meet the reporting requirements, you go to NASDAQ.
Isn't that the reverse way? I mean, don't you want to, like, be at Google and come out and blow the markets away, and you've got this big store, and everyone's hailing praises? I mean,
You do. Absolutely you do. I'm not saying that. But how many – I think last year there were maybe 5 IPOs in the United States. And if you're going to be one of those 5 IPOs, absolutely. But there were probably 250 or 300 reverse mergers in the United States. You know, and all of those raised capital. Now, I wouldn't do, you know, having done a lot of reverse mergers, I have a very defined process for how to do them. And there's obviously a lot, just like any business, there are things to avoid and things to be careful of, and it's not for everybody, but...
Joe, we're actually coming up to the end of our time here. I'm okay to keep going for another 15 minutes if you'd like to. If you want to keep telling us about how this works, depending on you.
Sure. I mean, okay. I've got time. We can do it.
Okay.
Let's do 15 minutes.
Okay.
Well, I mean, basically, the reverse merger process is a defined process where it always done, at least the ones that I always do, is what are called triangular mergers, which is a combination of capital, mm-hmm. a public vehicle, and a private entity. So I would not go public unless I had enough capital to make sure that the company was able to perform for at least the next year.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a very important part of the process. So a lot of people are in the business of just selling people public vehicles, and they say, don't worry, we'll raise you money after you go public, and that's very often problematic. So I like that. And in fact, you know, AOL was a reverse merger. MTI was a reverse merger. Archipelago, the New York Stock Exchange trading system, was a reverse merger. It's a very, very common process because what you do is it's very fast, and it bypasses millions of dollars of accounting and legal fees. Because to do an IPO is a very expensive, very time-consuming process. So then the issue, of course, is getting the stock trading. Now, that in itself is its own, you know, process, but it's, and that's why the CEO has to spend a third of his time talking to aftermarket investors, speaking at investor conferences, things like that. But at the end of the day, management raises money in common stock with no board control, no liquidity preference on the money, and they have a currency that they can go out and build their company. And if they execute on the plan, they'll be rewarded. You know, today, private companies sell at 2-3 times cash flow, and public companies sell at 20 times cash flow. So you can figure out the difference right there.
Why is there such a difference?
Why is it different in the public markets versus the private markets?
Yeah.
Well, because full value is in fact 20 times cash flow. In a public market, is given, you know, giving credit to the full value. In a private market, they're giving you discounts because of the fact that you are a private company and there's no competition for that. And so, as a public company, you wouldn't pay 20 times. You wouldn't pay what you're getting in the public markets for a private company. It just wouldn't be worth the acquisition costs. So you have to make that in order to do it. But there's no defined market. Now, sometimes you can get multiples of revenue. Okay, every once in a while, you have a YouTube. But for every YouTube that you have, which tells it's an infinite multiple of revenues and earnings, you have many, many other companies that either fail or sell at fractions of valuation. So if you can create the next YouTube or the next Google or the next Visa through, you know, more, for lack of a better word, traditional methods, I would do that all day long. But for somebody who's created a business that's growing at 50% a year, but it's doing $5 or $7 or $8 million of revenue, and says, how am I going to get to $50 million in revenue, and I need to raise a couple of $1 million in working capital, how am I going to do that? The reverse merger is certainly a viable option. It might be the most attractive option.
What kind of companies do you look for? I mean, let's say some of my guys are doing stuff like they're kind of like hydrogen, and so they're kind of building a brand, but at the end of the day, it's really around their sales letter, and it can be knocked off or duplicated and that kind of stuff. Do you want to work with companies like that, or do they need to have some type of recurring customer base? I mean, what constitutes a company you care about?
Well, look, it varies all over the place. I look at companies as disparate as oil and gas companies, done a couple of biotech companies, internet companies. The more attractive a company is in the public markets. I'll give you an example. I just did a company which supplies flat screen panels to automakers and for GPS systems and DVD systems in cars, both to the OEMs and to the aftermarket retrofit market. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Now the company growing 50% a year. Very cash flow positive, helped them raise some money and gave them a little bit of M&A guidance. And it's a company which, as soon as you say automaker, people's eyes glaze over. And they go, do I want to invest in a company that's selling, you know, people just have this feeling that the auto industry is a dead industry. So even though the company's performing really, really well, it's not a sexy industry.
Mm-hmm.
Having looked at 200 companies over the last 25 years, I can look at the company, the market it's in, and the financial metrics, and I can tell whether a company would be an easy or a hard one in the public markets. And it depends really on the entrepreneur and what he or she wants to do.
Everyone here reading this is an internet company, consumer marketing internet company.
Okay. That's a very, very hot market.
Okay.
That's a very sexy market.
So let's say an example. Let's say someone's doing a home business type product. It's teaching people how to make money from home. It's a very much a general interest mass market. He's got amazing cash flow. He's got to keep an eye on the FTC to make sure he's not going to get regulatory issues.
Right.
A company like that, is that the sort of company you can take public? Or do you prefer a social networking site? Do you prefer someone that's got a strong base with, you know, 24 months retention?
Yes, all of those are either candidates to do reverse mergers, or they're candidates to be acquired by companies which are trying to do reverse mergers or have done reverse mergers. In other words,
any and all of the above is what you're saying.
Yes, yes, absolutely. And, you know, depending on the thing which I always try to do is I try to understand what the goal is of the entrepreneur.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, is the goal to sell out and go off to the islands? Is the goal to build something even bigger? You know, is the goal, I've taken this company as far as I can by myself, and I need partners to help me. I want to be, with Scott's company, we found a bunch of guys that had grown a company, to a couple $1 million in revenue, and they were working out of their house, and they wanted to go into an office. They wanted to be part of a bigger group. They wanted to grow the business without having to worry about, hiring external people and payroll and all of that. They just wanted to focus on their business. It's just a whole bunch of different things. So I try to understand what the goal is of the entrepreneur, and then figure out, okay, what's the right financing strategy? What's the right deal? Because at the end of the day, if that guy is not happy, or gal is not happy, the deal doesn't work. So I don't try to, it's not like I have a model, and I try to cram everybody into that model. I just try to understand what...
You don't have a six-step process?
No. But people will always want to see that. I have people say to me all the time, send me the blueprint. You want to see the blueprint on how to be rich? Is that what you want? They go, yeah, I want to see the step-by-step. And having probably done 75 public MA transactions, and no two are alike. Not even close. They're all different.
Well, there's obviously a lot of guys who could work with you. Come on.
Well, I love the business of being in business. Well, I love to see different businesses anyway, so it's never a burden for me to talk to somebody about their business.
Well, let me give you a case study. There's a guy named on my list, who's named Dean Graziosi. He's a real estate, teaching how to make money in real estate. He's on late night infomercials on TV and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
He's doing about $60 million a year. He's, it's all built around his personality. He's actually sold a company before. He had bad experience, so he's probably going to be reluctant to sell again. They basically milked it very hard and then ended up doing some damage to his name. How would you approach someone like Dean?
Well, now you picked a real tough one.
That's my people, Joe.
Yeah. I'd really have to understand his business, okay? Because the big danger, here are the companies that I've seen that really haven't worked,
mm-hmm.
have been companies which tend to be around personality.
Okay.
So for every Martha Stewart, there's 100 Tommy Lasorda spaghetti sauces, mm-hmm. which went public with a reverse merger. So... I tried at Universe. I tried to buy Ron Popeil,
mm-hmm.
Vegematic.
Yeah, I know him. I read his book.
We tried to buy his business, and we couldn't get there between what he wanted and what we were afraid of was, if we buy his business, what is it all Ron? So I have to understand is the business the guy or is the business the system? The business
I've done an interview with him, so I know his business a little bit. He has, I think, a total of 5 employees, one of them who actually works with him on a more or less day-to-day basis, but I think he works out of his house. He has everything running through systems, and a lot of it's outsourced through external companies. So a lot of his name's on there, and he's working hard to make sure things sell and all of that kind of stuff, and his personality is over it. He's a guy that can spend a lot of time doing whatever he wants because he does have it very well organized. Does that kind of business work for you?
Yeah, now we're getting closer. Are you familiar with the Learning Annex?
Yes.
Okay. So the Learning Annex is a system. It's not the CEO, right? It's Donald Trump. It's, all the people he has working for him. Now, that business, because it's real estate, is in a down cycle.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, obviously, how to get rich in real estate is not a hot topic these days. So, I tend to be more towards consumer products because at the end of the day, everybody's buying consumer products like video games are having record years. And if we go in a recession, people spend more money on video games during a recession. So I have to understand the short answer is yes, but I'm trying to give you some of the process that I go through in order.
And so you're looking for guys that have read the Enid and have studied that sort of stuff and made things very much system time.
Right. Yeah. One of the things which I learned at Software Toolworks, Mindscape, was when Pearson came in to buy us, I was able to say to them, you're buying the company, you're not buying me. I've done it for 11 years. I love you guys, but I want to work for you guys. And they were happy with that. They said, we're buying a company. Yeah, we're not buying you.
How long did you have to stay around after the acquisition?
What happened was the day the proxy was completed, I handed in my letter of resignation, which they knew. And my guy at Pearson said, look, we'd really like you to stay. What would it take for you to stay? And I went back to my office, and I took a piece of paper, and I said, okay, I'll come into the office no more than one day a week. I can work on anything I want. I have no direct reports. I do mergers and acquisitions and strategic planning. you know, I only report to a CEO of an organization. You know, I put like 8 things down, handwritten on a piece of paper, and I gave it to him, and he initialed it, and he said, "Here, that's your employment contract. Go."
Oh, really?
So,
okay.
But they were great people, and so I stayed for a year. I actually worked a little bit on the BCIB transaction. I worked on a bunch of interesting transactions, but I don't have the mentality. I've done consulting for very big companies. I went into Penguin Books was a Pearson property. So I went out to Penguin Books, and I said, okay, I'd like to find some books that we can mine for video games. So, you know, they had Stephen King, you know, I'd like to do a Stephen King title. They had Tom Clancy, I'd like to do a Tom Clancy title. And so the guy said, well, tell me a little bit about your business. I told him about the business. He said, well, from the product time the product's done until it hits the market shelf, how long does it take? And I said, well, in the old days, when I really needed the money, it used to take about 24 hours, because I'd go down to the disk duplicator, and I'd shrink wrap the first 3 dozen boxes, and I'd put them in the trunk of my car, and I'd drive them to the retailer. So the box was hot, went cut to the shelf, because I needed money. I said, hey, you know, we're a little bit bigger, so sometimes it takes, you know, 3 or 4 days. And he said, oh, you know, in the printing business, you know, in the book business, we finish the manuscript, and it all goes to the printing press, and then if we can get it out a year afterwards, we've really accelerated the process. And then he said, you know, Stephen King, I don't know, we kind of like Stephen King, but we really think you ought to do the Royal Viking Opera Guide. That we think would really make a good software product. People look up their favorite opera and who was in it and when it debuted and all that. And so there was just this culture differentiation between what I wanted to do and what they wanted to do. And so after about a year of trying to navigate through that, I just went back to my boss and said, look, I've tried and I've done a few deals for you. And he said, I understand, and we shook hands. So that's, you know, I learned the best thing you could do is plan your obsolescence. You know, is when a business, what I always, having, again, started from nothing, I always wanted, I never got the feeling until we were a much bigger company that there were things happening in the business unless I made them happen. I don't know if I can describe that. Maybe you understand a little bit, you know. So you know, if there were things going on in your business that were happening when you actually weren't doing them, that's when you know you kind of have a company. And then the next step is to be able to say, if I went away for 6 months, the company would still be here. It might actually be better if I wasn't here for 6 months. And so,
just at one point, maybe you can answer this. One guy that I interviewed about a month ago, he sold his company for Delta DoubleClick for about $85 million. And he had to stay for 18 months in earnout. And, you know, it sounded like it was a fair amount of work. He had goals that he had to meet that were aggressive, and it took him a lot of time and effort. Another friend of mine in London who founded a company called Thought, that he sold to VeriSign for $575 million.
Uh-huh.
The sole owner. He told me that when he sold, he only had to basically hand over the reins, and he hung around for 6 months and wasn't really needed, and then he just moved on. It sounded like it was no drama. And so what you're saying there is that the difference is in the level of systematization in a company.
And frankly, what I like to do, I like the people in the companies, when I do one of these, like, you know, having Scott here, what I like to do is I like to build a management team with people from all these companies. I'm not looking for companies where you can just jettison the CEO. I like to build them by bringing people along with them. So the difference is I don't like earnouts. I like bonuses. So I like to be able to say to people, here's what your business is worth, and we'll pay you this. And now if you stay and you perform and you grow that business, here's how much extra you're going to make, as opposed to saying, well, you know, your business is only worth this much if you hit these numbers and you have to stay for 18 months. Because I've just learned that what happens is then you get into all kinds of arguments. Is it your sales? Is it my sales? How are we going to measure it? Wait a minute, I didn't think I had the pay these accounting charges and pro rata overhead. I have to try to structure them simply, but with incentives that make sure that people really want to stay.
Very good.
Okay.
I want to take more of your time.
No, I appreciate that, because I have some other calls I do need to make.
Okay. That's right. I need you to stand on the phone for a couple of minutes, but Joe, thank you very much for your time. Fascinating.
All right. My pleasure.